River run past Even Adams, past swerve of shore and bend of bay, in a commodus vicus of recirculation brings us back to the Religious Studies Project.
That was pretty phenomenal. I see that that was from Finnegan's Wake there.
Yeah, David. Famous opening line.
Fantastic. We're back after the new year. He's David Robertson.
And he's Christopher Cotter.
We are
the Religious Studies Project.
In the malt shovel. In Edinburgh.
By the back door to the historic and famous Mary King's Close.
Yeah. I haven't been there since about 8 years ago. My pal Elspeth, who actually did a degree at New College, was one of the guides there, so that was when I saw around it last. You might have been even longer, I guess.
Yeah. It was my 25th birthday or something like that. Yeah. It was before they opened the visitor centre.
Yeah.
And it was still just a man took you in with a torch and showed you around. The whole thing was sealed off. They didn't even have lights in there.
Fantastic.
Which was pretty scary.
Well, we are sponsored by the British Association for the Study of Religions, who hopefully have also had the most amazing Christmas and New Year break we have. And today we bring you the first interview of the new year, the first interview from our pal Tommy Coleman, our newly christened RSP assistant editor Tommy Coleman. We'll tell you more about that later. And it's an interview with Russell McCutcheon on Sui Generis Religion. I recently finally got around to reading Russell's book, Manufacturing Religion, which was, I believe, the outcome of his PhD thesis. It was published in 1997. And that's all about this sort of discourse on religion being a sort of thing in and of itself, the idea that you can use feelings of sacred and feeling, you know, to define religion. People saying, oh, well, that's... I watched a lecture by J.Z. Smith yesterday when I was doing the ironing. It was brilliant. And he was talking about how, you know, this religion, legal body in the U.S. was defining a religion as any organization which meets for religious purposes or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, and that is exactly what the discourse in Sui Generis Religion is, basically.
So. Well, I think Russell will tell us better than we can. So let's pass over to Tommy and Russell.
This is Thomas Coleman for the Religious Studies Project, and I'm here today with Dr. Russell McCutcheon. He's a professor at the University of Alabama and the department chair for the Religious Studies Department there. That is correct?
Yes, it is. Okay. I was chair from 2001 to 2009, then Ted Trost was chair, and he just finished 4 years, so I've just started this job again.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us here. Just to kind of frame the discussion for today, I wanted to point out a couple of the books that you've published over the years. One entitled Manufacturing Religion, The Discourse on Sui Generis and the Politics of Nostalgia. Another called Critics, Not Caretakers, Redescribing the Public Study of Religion. And certainly the Religious Studies Project is no stranger to the Critics, Not Caretaker question. And finally, The Discipline of Religion, Structure, Meaning, and Rhetoric. And include these today to kind of set us up for discussion on religion as a sui generis category. What is this thing we are referring to as sui generis? Am I even pronouncing it properly?
I think a lot of people say sui generis. Depending which form of Latin you're used to, you might say sui generis. Okay, kind of. But yeah. So you want to talk a little bit about that?
Certainly. What is this term, this category, this thing, you know, we might refer to? Is religion sui generis, or how does it become such?
My first book was certainly by no means the first to use this phrase. I don't think necessarily too many people were making that way of talking about religion an object of study, but all kinds of people have certainly written about religion, the thing that word religion names, as being unique, uncaused by something else, irreducible,
mm-hmm.
one of a kind, pre-political, pre-social, the presumption that our object of study is a pristine experience that can't quite be put into words. Here, words standing in for some kind of contingent historical public thing that is somehow not fully capable of expressing, literally expressing, right? Pushing out from inside out, like meat coming out of a meat grinder. Not capable of expressing the prior, interior, pre-political, unmediated experience. Mm-hmm. So I think all those things I've just been talking about is what, in one form or another, is packaged together in a view of religion that advocates for it, I think, in an earlier couple academic generations ago, were quite comfortable calling sui generis, self-generated, self-caused, not caused by another, you know, the unmoved mover, I guess. Whereas today, I think for a number of people, that signifies something problematic, even if they don't press the critique super far. I think it today signifies a bit of a loaded term and something that somebody at least has to take account of.
You touched upon the history of people. You certainly aren't the first person to use this term. I wonder if you could go over perhaps your understanding of where the term first appeared, where it was first employed, or at least implicitly.
Oh, I think it depends whether you're talking about scholars of religion or whether you're more broadly, I think, talking about the sui generis claim,
if
our object is somehow unique.
I just wanted to add to that in terms of the focus for this. Certainly interested in the category is employed in the study of religion, but also as it may bleed over into other academic disciplines or, you know, psychology of religion, for instance. I'm certain that that many of the approaches and categories of religion, we take a lot from them. So I just, if you could set it up kind of going into both directions.
Well, I was thinking even more broadly that I think, you know, the traditional notion of American exceptionalism, you know, there it is right there. In other words, if you see scholars of religion as cultural actors like anyone else, then we, I think, become interested in this notion of sui generis religion simply being one node among many others whereby social groups try to claim for themselves and their cultural productions some sort of preeminent status. So I think we see this all across cultural groupings, and scholars of religion are really no different, you know, making the claim that what they study, what they are somehow in control over, in possession of, some production of their own, is somehow freestanding, right? So the classic representation of this, I wrote a couple chapters on this, I've not really written much about Iliade, but because I've written a couple chapters on him and an essay somewhere else, some people think that that's mainly what I've written on. But he's a classical statement, right? All those people who, not all, but many of those people who helped establish religious studies in North America, especially in the late 50s, early 60s, were trading in this concept. You know, that was the argument, and that argument won the day that psychology, sociology, anthropology, they were all studying religion. But they were only studying a facet of it. They were not studying the, and if we, I don't know if many people read the 1950s and 1960s publications anymore, but this was the argument. They're not studying the irreducible core. They're missing the primary religious experience. They're not studying the cause of the social behavior, the cause of the psychological behavior or effect. So if you want to talk about sui generis religion, I think you need to talk about it as a socio-political strategy that was quite effectively used 50 years ago to help establish in American public universities brand new departments, brand new funding lines, brand new budgetary lines, because for whatever reason, and now what's the reason? That'd be interesting to study. That was convincing to administrators who, for all you know, themselves agreed with that and were devotees, practitioners, you know, who knows. So I think that's one of the reasons. I just see a book sitting over here beside me, Scott Elliott's book, Reinventing Religious Studies. He edited a book pulling together a variety of pieces from what was once called the Bulletin of the Council of Societies for the Study of Religion. It's been sold and reinvented, the online bulletin. blog is now part of that, but from the previous publication. And those pieces from the 60s and early 70s are quite interesting to read, because this is where people, I think, or when, and periodicals like what was once called the Bulletin, are duking it out over whether we deserve to exist as a separate institutional setting. Is our data unique?
What would it mean if, what is at stake? Are religious studies departments really threatened with being absorbed into other departments or being done away with if religion isn't kind of given a privileged status, so to speak? It's not special and of its own kind. It's merely, you know, another label.
It probably depends on, you know, each institutional setting, how well established the department is, how woven into its campus it's probably, you know, mid-level and senior faculty are. In other words, how easily it is or isn't taken for granted on a campus. But I would say huge numbers, especially post-2008, huge numbers of departments still probably are working very hard to trade on this somehow. They're not calling it sui generis. Now they're probably linking it into some kind of, well, which was linked to the 1960s and 70s too, Iliadi's New Humanism essay is a classic example. They're linking it into some kind of pan-liberal democratic humanism, right? We're studying the human spirit at its deepest and most noble. Like, this is the language that we'll very quickly see. A quick scan of departmental websites across the country, that welcome page, and just the images that are being selected on these pages, starts to confirm that, I think. I think the kinds of articles we often see in some of our field's leading journals confirm that this notion of religion as being unique has been retooled in light of the critiques, a bit of a rearguard action, you know, that has responded. So we don't see the category, we don't see it talked about the way it was 50 years ago. But we still see the same thing happening, I'd say. It's not very difficult to find a scholar of religion who thinks that their object of study is somehow a little more special than just studying Beowulf.
Does this play into the whole notion of homo religiosus, kind of an implicit sui generis-type category, whereby, you know, we don't refer it to that so much anymore, but it's implicit in how we treat it, how we write about it, and how it enters you know, the social scientific study as well?
I think so. I think that many social scientists in the study of religion, strikes me, this is a, you know, terrible generalizing comment, but they're interested in the outward expression of the prior inner sentiment. That's a very common model that we see across the field. It's counterintuitive, I would think, for many scholars today to think of, as some people do, to think of the word belief as naming a social residue. You know, I've quoted Zizek in a variety of times, riffing off of Althusser, riffing off of Pascal. You know, kneeling produces the physical behavior done in a ritualized setting, a social setting where you're basically forced to kneel as a little child the first time you kneel, if you're in a tradition that kneels, right? It's not like you're doing it because you believe something. Somebody pushes your shoulder down, as I've written. But it produces its own ideological foundation. You know, you kneel and you come to believe, quote-unquote, right, that you knelt because of your belief. I've written about this. I once asked a student, I talked about this in class just the other day, why they're a fan of Alabama football. And I asked that because I was trying to make this point, the sociological conditions of belief, and the student, it struck me, got it. So I threw that out there. Football's very big on our campus. And he answered the right answer, right meaning in this long line of critique. And he said, because my grandfather sat me down and made me watch them with him. So it's not that they're the best team, as if this social value is somehow preeminent, pre-social, just kind of exists of its own accord and we recognize it. No, he came to think of them as the best team because of a prior social condition. So I found that a really kind of enlightening moment with that student, because it strikes me still that for huge numbers of scholars of religion, there is something self-evidently and obviously religious about this or that act, hence the kind of sometimes anger that greets people who want to critique the category of religion. Instead of seeing the, as I said earlier, the ascribing unique status to someone, instead of seeing that as a rhetorical move that someone's doing, like Mansion on a Hill, U.S. exceptionalism, so many people can see that as a rhetorical strategy that's quite effective in sociopolitics. It's a shame that they can't use that same set of critical thinking tools to look at claims that human beings are somehow deeply religious, you know, this notion of homo religiosus. But to press that further, it seems that the retooling that has happened over the last, you know, 50 years is that the critique has happened, and so the comeback is that we're not studying necessarily something uniquely religious, we're instead studying meaning-making. So now it's not homo religiosus, but now it's, you know, humans' meaning-making machine. And the thing called religion for this side of the debate is, as I suggested earlier, the deepest and truest and most meaningful. And so we somehow still have a way of setting ourselves apart, though linking ourselves into this far wider liberal humanist model. It seems that's where the field, I disagree with it, but is quite comfortably resting today. So, and thus the ease of linking that to ecumenical movements, of interreligious dialogue, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
If understanding you correctly, then religion is certainly a socially constructed category and is pretty much a label that, that people apply to things because there is no religion in general, that there's no kind of Platonic form whereby, you know, we can recognize religion when we see it, because we know different things are religious for different people and not for others, even though it's a singular act or a thought or a feeling.
The critique of the category of religion, it takes many forms, I think. The one form I think it takes for a lot of people is that the problem is that we apply it too narrowly, right? So we see all kinds of people a couple generations ago became quite enamored, and I think they still are, with Wittgenstein's notion of family resemblance, right? Or baseball as religion, right? Yeah. We see all these studies interested in popular culture and religion. The goal here seems to be to open the tent up wider and wider and wider, so more and more and more things count as religion because of some kind of critique that seems to be made that it's wrong to exclude things. Though really the utility of a definition is directly linked to what it excludes, if you think about it. You know, reading glasses is a handy concept for me because it allows me to narrow down very quickly many, many things on my desk to a very specific set of things. The utility of that is linked to what it does not name, right? But I think the critique of the category of religion that many people take is that they think it's too narrow, and thus they ought to count more and more things, and thus we have these very wide definitions that religion is the depth of feeling or something like that. The version of the critique that I'm interested in, and I think a relatively small group of people, is simply to see the category of religion, the very word tied to a specific sort of definition, tied to the different elements orbiting in that semantic universe, the notion of belief and faith and ritual, to see that as a rhetorical tool social actors use, like any rhetorical tool, to do things, to organize people, to prioritize people, to delimit people, to rank people, to put some people up, some people down. In other words, I think what I just described is what we often mean by culture. I think that's just what it means to exist, is that we rank, we distinguish, we prioritize, we focus, we ignore. And the category of religion in certain human societies, fairly recently, I would think, in human history, has been one very effective way of doing that. And so the critique of the category of religion I'm interested in is maybe to some people terribly ambitious, but to me it's a very simple critique, is to see the term as a rhetorical item like any, and not a neutral descriptor that's in some one-to-one relationship with something in the world. there's a group called Culture on the Edge that I'm a member of now. It's a small group, seven of us. We blog. We have a book series. So just today I wrote an entry. Who knows when and if this will air. But just today I wrote an entry. There was a little girl in the state of Oklahoma who was turned away from class, basically, in a charter school. So not a public school, not exactly a private school, charter school. Not quite public, really. For having the wrong hairstyle, an African-American young girl. They're having the quote-unquote wrong hairstyle. And the school's rules were that faddish hairstyles were not allowed. And the blog was about the ease of many readers of seeing that word faddish, like a fad. The ease of many readers seeing that as a loaded rhetorical word being used by one social group to duke it out with others, to say what you're doing is temporary and fleeting, but what we're doing is enduring, right? Shakespeare's really literature, but that isn't. Readers would read faddish and have no trouble seeing all kinds of arm wrestling going on at that point. And the point of the blog was, gee, I wish that same critical vision could be used when they see somebody call something religious. They see somebody call something unmediated, when they see somebody call something deep. I gave that deep thought. You know, just because you say the word deep doesn't make something any deeper. Like, it's a metaphor of depth. So I guess my interest in the category of religion then becomes to take seriously that this word and what we do with that word and the associated words and concepts we use are ways that we as social actors arrange the worlds we inhabit and move within them. And I think that's a pretty modest interest, to be quite honest. But given the heavy work that category does for people, it does call a lot into question for them. So thus, I think I understand their reaction to that work.
Doesn't the very process of critique perhaps help to reify the sui generis type culture? Does it somehow contribute to the sui generis thought, you know, merely by pointing it out, you know, saying what you are, in a sense, if I'm correct, kind of saying what it is and what it's not to a wide extent?
What do you mean what it is and what it's, what's the it?
Defining, insofar as we always have to define things, this kind of notion of defining what sui generis is, how do we know when something is kind of, you know, set aside in such a where we can't touch it, can't question it like we might other things, like you pointed out for your example on Culture on the Edge with regards to the use of fad.
I would be quite comfortable probably with all kinds of scholars of religion using the category religion if they simply said right from the start that it's their category, it's their tool, and they're going to stipulate how they use it, and now I'm just going to get on with using it that way, right? That's the problem. We use that category as if it's a neutral descriptor of things. I will often use the Nix, N-I-X, Nix versus Hedden, 1893 U.S. Supreme Court case on whether a tomato is a fruit or a vegetable. It's a brief little court case. You look it up on Wikipedia or Google. They imported tomatoes. There was a U.S. 1883 Tariff Act, trade tariff, right? Duties on imports. From 1883, that said importing fruits, there's one set of consequences. If you're importing vegetables, there's another set of consequences. And the debate became, what is a tomato? Because people had imported tomatoes, a lot of them, from the West Indies, and they were taxed. What I like about that decision, apart from being very, very brief, you know, Supreme Court decisions were very brief 100 years ago compared to now, is that the judge, Justice Gray, makes very clear in this brief little decision that he really doesn't care what a tomato really is. You know, it's a very sophisticated decision, I think. He makes clear that he's simply interested in what a tomato will be for purposes of trade and tariff. Right? For the purposes of this act, will it be a vegetable or will it be a fruit? I don't see many people who use the category religion using it in that way, that I'm really not interested in what religion really is or isn't, or if there even is such a thing that pairs up to that word. Instead, it's a word I'm using, defined in this or that way, that allows me to do this or that with the world, that allows me to talk about this versus that, and I don't know what all one can do with it. I think that's how we use language myself. Sure. That I mean, I guess by seeing it as rhetorical, the way we're doing things with words. I think I'd be quite comfortable with all sorts of people stipulating. See, the problem with that then comes in when you do that. When you stipulate, for my purposes, religion is belief in God. You know, there we go. Mm-hmm. Just somebody's bound to say, aha, what about Buddhism? Well, and there's the moment where the two systems are bumping into each other, that somehow this other person already knows Buddhism to be a religion, thus it's a counter instance, yet to the stipulative definition, it isn't. It mm-hmm. isn't. I just stipulated how the word works. It's not a counter instance. But it is a counter instance if that person who responded somehow has privileged pre-linguistic information about what really is or isn't a religion. Instead of producing more descriptive evidence from Buddhism to say, yes, it is, yes, it isn't, what those two people really ought to recognize is they've got two different stipulative definitions up and running that are bumping into each other. And they're not going to resolve that. And here I'm just riffing off Jonathan Smith. They're not going to resolve that at the level of data. They've got to resolve that at the level of theory. They've got to have a discussion about their two different definitions, why they're using them differently. If you're using a stipulative definition that religion is belief in God, go with it, run with it, and pay the consequence. You can't talk about everything.
So, however you're going to define religion, you're going to include some things and leave out other things that a whole group of people would consider religious, is where what I understand.
And if you're using a definition in a stipulative manner, perfectly fine. My goal is not to use a concept in a way that matches the things in the world that are already it.
Certainly.
The concept is there. You've got some kind of pre-linguistic God's eye view of the universe, and you know that there's really bottles out there, and you better come up with a word capable of naming them, right? No, for me it's the exact opposite, that language and sets of assumptions, sets of judgments, all social conditions. I was taught language. I did not ask to speak English. I did not sit there as a small baby and rashly consider whether the cow really does say moo or not. It was just repeated to me as a very, you know, after people had leaned in and said boo, 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 and like all those important linguistic acquisitions, things we went through. For me, then, language is a way of ranking, excluding, focusing, paying attention to the world. I'll sometimes walk onto the balcony of our building. I'm in an old 19th century brick building with New Orleans style wrought iron railing balconies. We have no hallways. You just walk out your room and you're on this big balcony. There's a very nice quad. It's a very pretty setting here at the University of Alabama. And I will walk out there with students sometimes and say, what should we pay attention to? It's just all kinds of things. You know, are you a botanist? Are you interested in the movement of crowds on campus? Do you work with grounds? Are you interested in that muddy path over there? Should interlocking stones be put down? Are you interested in the architectural design? Are you interested, was this originally a fort? There's just too many things to pay attention to. So it seems that getting on with the business of talking about the world means developing ways to ignore the vast majority of things. As I say to students in class, you know, what do your feet feel like in your shoes? If I ask that question, they probably don't even know they have feet. It's just not a relevant item in their world. And to me, that's fine. That's what I meant by earlier, that the utility of a definition, certainly it could be so narrow as to not have utility either. The question is, you know, where's that sweet spot? But the utility of a definition is based in large part on the number of things it does not allow you to talk about, and being happy with paying that consequence. In light of it allowing me to talk about X, I can't talk about all these other things. And that's a fine price to pay. Sadly, many scholars of religion strike me as wanting to talk about it all, the depth, the transhuman, and I just think that's rather sloppy scholarship, to be frank.
Is there a point at which kind of stop critiquing this category and start perhaps studying it in terms of in a traditional manner? Are we always supposed to be reflecting upon essentially this is a socially constructed category and it doesn't really exist in general. When can we really dive into something in terms of religious studies?
The day scholars start saying, yeah, it's my stipulative definition, I use it. The vast majority, not the vast majority, listen to me, I generalize, right? But a lot of people, they want to take the category, the critique, and they want to do the politician's little two-step. Yes, but. I love that move. Yes, but. Which is an incredibly paternalistic way of managing the critique. You acknowledge it, but then you just get on and do what you would have done anyways. So I see all kinds of books that recognize there's a critique of the category, but then they got a chapter on Hinduism and Buddhism. And you know, all kinds of people know that they ought to, quote-unquote, know that they ought to acknowledge the critique of the category of world religions, for example. That it has a colonial era, history, that way of dividing up the world. But then they all still know that there's Buddhists out there and there's Hindus out there. They all just get on with the work they would have done instead of taking really seriously that even if we think there's human behavior to be seen and smelt and recorded like what we're doing, that the way in which we manage that information, organize it, look for similarities and differences across settings, that's us that's bringing that to the table. And if we have problems with one way of doing it, then the data is going to look pretty different when we start organizing it in a different way. You know, I've sometimes said to people, how would you write the history of that period we call the Reformation now without the category of religion, without the presumption that faith was inside and publicly expressed outside? Critique that whole set of assumptions, then you're not even going to talk about the Reformation anymore. You're going to talk about in that historic period. Are you going to talk about proto-nation states? Are you going to talk about, it could be quite interesting if you don't presume that your categories of analysis, your tools, are in one-to-one correspondence with reality. So I think the critique is itself constructive work. It's challenging people to own their categories and to reconsider how to talk about the things we talk about.
Kind of in closing here, I was wondering if your critique, does it change or perhaps intensify if we apply it to the social scientific study of religion, be it psychology of religion or cognitive study of religion? What does it mean when we're all of a sudden using these, you know, empirical methods and giving scales to people about religion, of which kind of really doesn't exist in general? It's purely something that the researcher has deemed religious.
Well, yeah, that's the interesting thing about the social sciences. The social scientific study of religion is where some promise was held. But when I look around, it just seems that it's the sui generis religion. I've written about this. Mm-hmm. It's just through the back door. Because we're not trying to develop a...
How so?
Well, we're not trying to develop a theory of hierarchicalization. We're not trying to develop a theory of representation. It's never trying to develop a theory of religion, because this one thing is a particularly curious thing that we have to somehow solve. So it's not that social sciences are seeing human beings as involved, I'm broad generalizing here, human beings as involved in broad transcultural things. Like, we all are engaged in representation. We're all engaged in signification. We're all engaged in hierarchicalization. So let's develop some focus on that. No, we're still trying to develop a theory of religion because it is somehow a distinguishably, dare I say, unique aspect of culture that needs a very specific theory to explain it. And that strikes me as, I'm not sure what has changed in the last 50 years. Let's press further. Let's come up with a theory of hierarchicalization that's no longer going to go looking for, well, we need some specifically Buddhist data. No, no, no. We need some cross-cultural data in all kinds of different domains that we might subdivide for whatever sake of convenience and call it literature, you know, call it culture, call it religion. But we're trying to transcend that and to talk about species-wide things. But no, we come back to this category of religion often as if it's picking out something uniquely distinguishable that is, I don't know, somehow locked in our genes. Just seems to me a curious almost, you know, medicalization of a discourse that a number of people thought was problematic 20 years ago. But it strikes me that it's still here. I'd rather see a cross-cultural theory of signification.
Mm-hmm. No? Well, would it be safe to say that we're studying something? We shouldn't even name it yet, but it's previously and currently has been labeled for some people religion.
Well, not to me, because that seems that there is a something out there, and the word's going to hook up to it somehow. And I'm thinking there's something out there. If we all act like there's religion, then there is something out there. Mm-hmm. You know, the stop sign means stop only because we all stop at it. It seems to me that back to kneel and you will come to believe you knelt because you stop at the stop sign. You come to believe that the sign made you stop. Like think. I think when we think about it, we would say, no, actually it's sets of assumptions I have about other drivers and safety and, you know, that we all know the stop sign doesn't mean stop, doesn't express stop, that it's a arbitrary neutral totem in our environment, you know, that we use as a convenient externalization of a set of assumptions that we walk around with, that we're trained with in social life, you know. You could easily teach somebody to mean, to think green meant stop, you know, for example, that would be very difficult, be very nasty, would be very difficult. So it seems to me that the problem is in presuming that our tools necessarily line up to transcultural things outside ourselves, instead of just saying, no, it's my curiosity, it's my tool. I'll hopefully define it in a common enough way that other people can get some point of purchase on it, because now I can be in a department, now I can have colleagues, now I can have people read my results. Yeah, I get that. So I think that's one of the biggest problems of our field, is that we ontologize our tools and think that, you know, it's like everybody thinking their babies are pretty and everybody else will agree. We just necessarily think our tools are universal.
There's probably got to be an ugly baby somewhere.
Baby somewhere. I wrote a post on... kind of related to that, but that's another story.
Okay. Dr. McCutcheon, is there anything else you'd like to share with us? Kind of some open space, anything you'd like to say before we close today?
No, I hope this is useful to hear me rambling on a Thursday afternoon here in Alabama on a sunny September day, and it was
nice. Thank you. Well, that sounds like a country song right there, rambling in sunny Alabama. So, all right, thank you, Dr. McCutcheon.
That was Tommy Coleman talking to Russell McCutcheon on the subject of sui generis religion. And hey, it's great to have Russell actually on the show properly.
Yeah.
Our first interview, and hopefully we'll be doing some more. I tell you what, he's done an interview for us. He's going to be our new interviewer later this year. He's talking to Stephen Ramey.
It's really good. And I guess we've got quite a sort of close, at least social media association with Culture on the Edge. There's a lot of good stuff coming out of that. They did a panel on identification rather than identities for us, which we put out as a podcast maybe 6 months ago or so now.
And Russell's also the series editor on the book that you and I are putting together, Chris, isn't that right?
Yes, there's a lot of synchronicity going on here, to use a sort of ambiguous term there.
It's a synergy, Chris.
Yeah.
Synergy. And exactly the kind of thing that the Religious Studies Project should be fostering. People getting to work together that wouldn't have come across the work, but by doing little bits here and there we can make connections and work happens.
To fire quickly on and not bore you too much with our sort of blathering, the big bit of news today is about the sort of editorial team at the RS Project. We have, due to personal reasons and academic reasons and professional reasons, a couple of our editorial team had to step down at Christmas there. So just to say a big thank you to Per Smith and particularly Louise Connolly, who's been with us right from the start, for all their sterling work. You can read a bit more in last week's Opportunities Digest, and I'll maybe put it in again. I'm sorry, 2 weeks ago, thinking into the future. But yeah, they both did a great job, and particularly Louise with the posters, the social media, marketing, the Ops Digest.
Well, Louise was literally the first person involved in the project that wasn't either I or Chris who'd come up with the idea in the first place. So, and her advice and assistance was invaluable at the beginning, and she was a real... what's the word? A real...
Rock?
A rock for the project, yeah.
On which to build our podcast.
She was reliable week in, week out with the Opportunities Digest and tweeting all of that stuff. And, as well as being an interview for us, an interviewer for us, as well as writing response.
Two responses.
Round tables. So she'll be sorely missed, and her as well, of course, will be sorely missed. But their absence... pushed us into doing something that we'd been talking about for a while, which was to
restructure.
Is what when we were opening up the kind of the spaces that they'd opened up, we thought, well, let's systematize things a little bit more, let's formalize things and take it to the next level by basically making the editorial board an editorial board and not just...
a collection of people who are interested in helping out the project.
Yes, exactly. Especially as we'd been having a lot more people just doing interviews for us here and there, we felt that the editors needed to...
have their own roles.
Yeah, have a distinct role that they were able to make their own and innovate in, as well as...
So what do we do? Well, keeping with the people who were... already editors, what's happened now? Jonathan Tuckett of the University of Stirling, who's been with us again pretty much since day one, he is now going to take charge of book reviews, so we're hopefully going to get a few more book review podcasts out on a more regular basis, as well as the textual book reviews that we did that last time. We've then got Chris Silver, who is taking charge of social media, along with Tommy Coleman, who you've just heard speaking there. So Tommy's a new addition to the team.
Tommy's been a collaborator of Chris Silver's for a while, and Chris sort of encouraged him into doing a few interviews for the project. He took that bait and ran with it, as you will see over the coming months. And so we wanted to reward his enthusiasm and hard work. He's been doing a lot of beyond the Call of Duty, you know, rounding up respondents and helping, being involved in the organising of the Psychology of Religion panel that we had. So now the two of them together are going to continue to work as a strong team that they obviously are, and they've taken charge of the social media, running Google+ and Facebook and Twitter.
Jack Sonis is now going to be our advertising and publicity kind of and fundraising chap. It's a position that we've not had before, but that we've sort of been doing on an ad hoc basis, and we're looking forward to
it. Jack pitched it to us that's what he should do, and we couldn't say no, really.
Absolutely. Hannah Lettinen is going to be taking charge of... We've got a resources section on our website that you'll have seen, which sort of lists journals, religious studies departments. We have some sort of features on, academic visibility and the thesis on professionalization that Russell wrote. But that's kind of stagnated. There's no one been taking charge of it. So we're looking forward to Hannah developing that, building it up into a more useful resource, and also liaising with... various religious studies and relevant conferences happening around the world to try and get the RSP having a presence there to get conference reports and things like that.
So yeah, as you'll see, a lot of this stuff is things that we were kind of doing ad hoc or wanted to do or had started doing but had run out of time. I mean, the amount of time it takes on a weekly basis to put these podcasts and the project together is quite considerable. And so now by...
Delegating
the work, democratizing the responsibility, hopefully it'll mean that all of these little details get taken care of, but also that we then have time to make the other developments. Have we mentioned everybody?
Well, Knut,
obviously, is, he's just going to continue to be Knut.
Making the website awesome and answering sort of every query we have, he comes up with a way to sort it, and we're really grateful to have Clue on board. So then we've already mentioned Tommy as a new face. We've got two more.
Have we mentioned Kevin?
We haven't mentioned Kevin.
No, Kevin's going to be doing the Kevin Roundtable regular Whitesides has come into the project officially, and he's going to be looking after the Wednesday responses. Something which he's already started, and we've got the first few of those queued up. And we'll tell you a little bit more about what's coming up in the coming weeks, in next week's in next week's episode, because we've talked
a lot. And the final edition,
but yes, go ahead.
Daniel Vivand, he's here at the University of Edinburgh, although he's also another one of our American colleagues, and he is going to be taking a major load off David's back in terms of audio editing. There's a lot, you know, because when we get these interviews in, you know, there's sometimes breaks for you know, there's interruptions, there's coughing, there's noises. There, sometimes people start off on a train of thought and then get lost and have to start again. You know, there's a fair bit of editing that needs to be done there. So. Mm-hmm.
As well as, you know, cleaning them up, leveling them, EQing them all so it sounds nice, you know, especially the situations. The way that the project works is, you know, we don't have a studio, we don't, we're not recording for an hour to get perfect quality. A lot of these recordings are done quite guerrilla style, and so sometimes there is a lot of cleaning up to be done. But hey, that's how we get, you know, the off-the-cuff and passionate kind of discussion that I hope we managed to capture. But there is one more post, actually. Chris, isn't there?
Yeah. We want someone to, because Louise had been managing these Opportunities Digests for at least the past year. I'd done them for a bit before we sort of systematized it, and then she's been running them for well over a year now. So we're looking for someone to take over the Ops Digest position and to, you know, potentially rebrand it, expand it, do something a bit different with it. So there's an advert in every Ops Digest that we've published in 2014, and we're looking for applicants for that position until the end of January. So, yeah.
And we'll be making a decision at the end of January and announcing one final member of the editorial board.
But for now, we're approaching 1,500 followers on Facebook now. Mm-hmm. I read about
1,449 this morning. Yeah, it was.
That's fantastic. Twitter's going well. Google Plus is picking up. Is it? Yeah.
I don't know. Well, I don't do Google Plus anymore.
Exactly. We're now becoming the sort of doddery managers that don't know what's going on in their own corporations. It's great. And please keep using amazon.com.co.uk and .ca. There was a real influx over Christmas, and we're so grateful for that. Just keep it up.
Yeah. You guys rule. The BASR rule. Thanks for listening.